Welcome to PM Lessons Learned, a podcast for project managers, helping project managers by sharing lessons learned. Increase your PM knowledge, build business relationships, increase your effectiveness, increase your marketability, gain professional support. Join our group and take part in our conference calls. Details at pmlessonslearned.com.
Hello, this is Henry Will, and welcome to another pmlessonslearned.com conference call. This is our monthly call with PM best practices and where project managers share PM lessons learned. Today is September the 16th, 2010, and this is podcast number 105. Today we're going to be talking in a moment with Kevin Iguano. I am very appreciative of him at the last minute of agreeing to help us out and present to our call. Several of you have heard him present before, and we've had some great feedback on the presentations that he's given. But before that, I just want to make a couple of quick announcements. One is that we're always looking for volunteers. If you look at the emails we've sent out lately, we're always looking for volunteers to help with podcasting our calls and with some of the other hosting of the calls and that type of thing. If there's a place where you think you could help the group out, please send us an email at share, S-H-A-R-E, at pmlessonslearned.com. You know, this is one of three monthly calls that we have. On the first Thursday every month, we have a PMP exam study group call. The second Thursday every month, we have a PM job shop call. And on the third Thursday, you know, these are all on Thursdays, the third Thursday every month is this call, our PM best practice call. Now, we also have a virtual study group for those that are very serious about studying for their PMP exam that meets on a weekly basis. And that group requires you to be a little bit more committed. You have to agree to take turns to do the presentations. So the people in that group are a close-knit group of people that kind of know each other, and they take turns doing the presentations, preparing to study. We find that people, if they do the presentations, they learn the subject matter better. If you're interested in that, you could send an email to study at pmlessonslearned.com. So now you'll find that you know, our group is growing. We're getting more members. We now have our LinkedIn group. You can find those all on the link on the links on the left-hand side of our website. You'll see also, if you want to download the presentation for today, if you go to our website at pmlessonslearned.com, on the left-hand side, if you scroll down, you'll see a link for files and presentations that will contain the directions to how to find the presentation that goes with tonight's call. So as I said, tonight we have with us Kevin Iguano. He is a person that's got lots of credentials. He's got his PMP, his IPMAB, he's got his MAPM. He's a certified executive project manager with the company that he works for. He's got all kinds of credentials as far as WCM and eForms solution manager. He works in that space. He's also well known for working in the agile project management application of agile and project management. He's written several books. You can find out more at his website, or you could contact him through his profile on LinkedIn. And he's also the vice president of the Project Management Association of Canada. I guess when you get right down to it, if you read the bio that we sent out, you'll see that Kevin's got a lot of credentials that prove that he's a good speaker. He's well known in the speaking circuit for project management. He's done keynotes. He's trained. He's done coaching, especially in agile management methods. And he's taught thousands of people how to manage high change projects using the techniques of agile, like Scrum and extreme programming, feature-driven development, and other agile methods. So you're going to find that the information that he shares with us this evening is going to be very helpful. As I said, some of you may have listened to the other presentations he's done here on PM Lessons Learned, or perhaps you've heard him elsewhere. If you want to, you can go back in our archives, which are located, again, there's a link on the left-hand side of our website. You'll see it says Archive of Past Call Audio. you could look there and find the information that he's presented on before, or just do a search on our website for his name. He's written over 20 different books. He's done audiobooks and DVDs, in addition to a number of articles that he's published in magazines and also journals worldwide. So, Kevin, I thank you very much for agreeing to present, like I said, at such a late notice here on TMLessonsLearned.com. Our speaker fell through. We're trying to reschedule with them. And tonight's topic is going to be managing in the face of ever-changing requirements. Kevin, thank you again, and take it away.
Thank you very much, Henry. And I do hope the audio quality is good. If there's a problem, let me know. So I hope everyone has a chance to download a copy of the presentation. The presentation will be very helpful, but not necessary to get benefit from this call. There is a link on the website, pmlessonslearned.com, where you can download the presentation and follow along. So to begin, tonight's topic is really about how to deal with projects that are highly complex or where there's high levels of change. Sometimes there are projects where we just can't build a proper baseline. Sometimes we can't build a project plan because we're not even sure what the deliverables are yet. Or a client is having a hard time making up their mind what their requirements are, yet we need to get started on ones that we do know something about while they're still trying to figure out the rest. Or, this has happened to me one time, we're working on a project where the deliverable, the final output of the project is going to be described by government legislation, yet the way the government rules work, after the legislation is passed, we would have to have the system up and running within a month to be compliant with the regulation for the government, yet during the legislation process, during all the approvals, lobbyists and other political parties were constantly making changes to the deliverables. It took about 8 months to do this work, so we had to get started while the scope was still constantly in flux. And then sometimes you're going to meet stakeholders, sponsors, people who really don't know what they want till they see it. They may have a general vague idea, but as soon as you show them the deliverable, they're going to start coming back with feedback to you. In a traditional waterfall-type linear project, that's the first time they see it is at the end of the project, really. You get them to sign off on some specifications and design documents maybe at earlier phases in the project, but some people really don't understand that stuff. We tend to create documentation full of lines and boxes and arrows and really complex diagrams that business stakeholders really don't understand. And then when it comes time to actually viewing the final deliverable, we often hear things like, that's not what I said, or maybe that's what I said, but it's not what I meant, or, oh, that reminds me, I forgot something, or, oh, that's what you meant, well, let me re-clarify what I've been telling you all the way along, and we end up with change. And on a waterfall project, the worst time to get feedback is at the end, because you're automatically going to be late and over budget, because you got to go fix all that stuff now and do a bunch of rework. So what we're looking at is in those projects, and these are a reality of our trade, you cannot avoid these projects. On these high change projects, our traditional project planning approaches start to fail. Earned value doesn't work when the baseline keeps shifting on you. The metrics become meaningless in terms of forecasting future productivity. We need another approach. So I'm on slide 3 right now, titled We Work at the Edge of Chaos. I'm going to share with you 2 case studies that I'm going to come back and revisit later on in the presentation. The first one is Chrysler Corporation, the auto manufacturer. Used to have 3 payroll systems. They had one for executives who got paid, you know, all these performance bonuses at the end of each year, but otherwise they got, you know, a regular salary. They had one for salespeople who got salary plus commissions. And then they got one for, they had a system for the line employees, the hourly workers who work in the factories who had all kinds of benefits and things that were negotiated by their union contracts. So at one time they had 3 payroll systems. It was an extremely complex environment because every union was negotiating all kinds of unique benefits and agreements, and they were using this payroll system to cover many, many different legal jurisdictions, different states, different countries, et cetera, that was causing quite a lot of complexity in the system. Now, 3 payroll systems, they had 3 different sets of IT staff maintaining them, 3 different groups of people in the HR department using these systems, all separately trained, 3 different infrastructures to host them on it. You know, there was quite a business case here for consolidation. They built the business case. They looked at it and saw there was a significant benefit if they could find one package to handle everything. So they did an evaluation of what was available in the marketplace. And, you know, they looked at PeopleSoft and SAP and things like that, and they realized there wasn't a package that really easily met their needs. It would require heavy amounts of customization, and the cost would be prohibitive. They thought, you know what, it might be better to build something custom from scratch to meet our exact needs, which, you know, may have been a very valid business decision at that time. So what had happened was they initiated such a project. The project progressed for a while, but it quickly became a complete failure. They had tons of complexity. The project was floundering. The real issue was they couldn't get out of the design phase. This is very common in high-change environments. You capture requirements. You're asking for sign-off on the requirements, and as soon as you ask for sign-off, you know, now all of a sudden people start to really pay attention. You know, you may have been floating draft deliverables in front of them, but they may or may not have read them. And as soon as you ask for sign-off, now all of a sudden they're going to read them carefully, and they may ask for, you know, other people to take a look at it. Someone won't sign unless, you know, their whole department agrees or a committee has looked at it that, you know, they haven't necessarily consulted before. And all of a sudden, new requirements start to emerge, you know, as you engage stakeholders that haven't been engaged in the process already. So you have to go back and re-update your design, you know, your requirements document, go back again for more sign-off, and they couldn't get out of this design phase. So design has two aspects. The first is requirements, and the second is some kind of solution design. So they either got stuck getting requirements signed off, or even if they could get requirements signed off, now they design a solution to meet those requirements and get the and you know, these are traditional waterfall type approaches, a very detailed design up front. They had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages of documentation describing the solution, it's the estimates and all the and all the details of the scope and roles and responsibilities and all the detailed data analysis and everything else that was done as part of that design. It took many, many, many months to prepare all that information. They take it forward for sign-off, now all of a sudden what comes up? Well, we missed a stakeholder, or oh, that, you know, things have changed in the meantime. We've negotiated a new contract with a new union that has some unique requirements. So they all of a sudden they had to go back, re-update the requirements, re-update the design, re-estimate and re-plan the whole project, and come back with a new design, a new budget and timeline. Well, just that replanning process could take many weeks, and by then more requirements changed. So they got constantly stuck in this mode where they were updating their designs, re-estimating the whole project, coming back for sign-off, and then finding out that they missed something else. That particular project was deemed a failure because they'd been at it for a long time and weren't making progress. They got stuck, as I said. The project was terminated, and a new project team was brought on. In this case, they brought on people like Kent Beck and Ron Jeffries and eventually Ward Cunningham and some other people you might be familiar with because they're quite famous in the object-oriented development community. They were brought on and because they said, we have a different approach. We have a methodology that we've been toying with that we think is made for these high-change environments. So they were given a shot. And they succeeded. They rewrote what was done, and within a year, they were releasing the first version. And the methodology that they used on that was an agile methodology, or came to be called agile later on, and that was extreme programming. And that was the method that was born on that project to get that project unstuck from this design churn. Another classic example was a commercial leasing application for a large Asian bank. It was a very complicated system. These people were doing it by the book, however. They were following best object-oriented development best practices, but in a waterfall-type mentality. Get all the requirements signed off, do all of your design, get the design signed off before you start development. At 2 years into the project, these guys had 3,500 pages of design docs. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen 3,500 pages, but for fun, I took stacks and stacks of paper and stacked them up to equal 3,500 pages, and it's a stack of paper a couple feet thick. Now, realistically, nobody is going to have all that information in their head all at one time. It's just not going to happen. It's too much information for one person to really get their head wrapped around. So what happens is we end up with specialties. Certain people understand certain parts of the solution really well. When that happens, you know, it's very common that we get stuck in very long cycles of assessing the impact of change. So in this case, they were trying to get sign-off. You know, this bank operated in multiple jurisdictions. There would be new requirements coming up, government legal changes about how leases are being handled and buyouts at the end of leases and all of this kind of stuff. And what ended up happening was there'd be change. So they'd go back, and instead of just assessing the impact of the change, which would be easy if it was a simpler solution, nobody understood the whole solution. So these guys would have to sit down and start reading the documentation all over again and start flipping through 3,500 pages to figure out all the different places that this change might impact, update the documents to show the impact of those changes, figure out the impact to their estimates and timelines, and go back with, the change request to get approval and the updated documents. Well, that process, because it was so complex and so many thousands of pages of documentation, took them weeks and weeks and weeks to assess the impact of one change. Well, this is a highly dynamic environment, and, change was occurring constantly, so they could never, their backlog of changes to assess was often dozens and dozens at any given time. They could never get out of this design phase. So again, after 2 years, the project was canceled. In this case, they engaged a different team who came in and said, we have a way of fixing this. And that was Peter Cole and Jeff DeLuca, who came in with a different methodology that they said might help get the project unstuck, and indeed they did. And it was that methodology became called feature-driven development. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. These situations are not uncommon. We find them even on smaller projects, projects where the scope is just fuzzy or there's just too much change coming at the team to be responsive. So, moving on to slide 4, our traditional methods don't work. When we're faced with high change like that, the first thing our PM classes tell us is to, tighten up the control on the scope, lock it down. Even if we know it's not 100% perfect, just freeze it. Don't allow any more change and plan and build based on the version that you have, and then deal with the change later on. So, build version 1 and then hold off on the changes and do those later as a version 2. At least you make some progress on the stuff that isn't changing. The problem with that is that we end up building something that nobody can actually use. The business needs the changes, or else they wouldn't be asking for them. And if you're giving them a solution that doesn't include all those changes, they're going to have to wait for the change, usually, before they can actually deploy it and start using that solution. So all that wasted time for user acceptance testing, or even just integration testing if it's a software application, all of those, all that wasted effort in testing and retesting again, is unnecessary, because you're going to be doing a second version later that really does meet their needs. In the engineering and construction world, if you build something that doesn't meet the needs on the first pass, often, retrofitting requires ripping down walls and ripping up concrete, and it's a big, large, messy, expensive process that can easily be avoided if you just waited a bit longer and figured out the impact of the change. So, building the stuff that we know as of today isn't good when you know there's changes pending. So we need a different approach. So on to slide 5, what I'm going to talk about today is agile development, agile project management. Agile was designed as a way of dealing with these highly complex, high-change environments and still keeping things under control. There's a lot of misunderstandings about agile, and I'm going to try and clear up some of them today. I'm going to talk about some of the principles behind agile, how it's different from how we traditionally manage projects. I'm going to walk you through a high-level overview of Scrum, Extreme Programming, and Feature-Driven Development. And I'll give you some techniques that you can use today on your projects. Even if you choose not to become fully agile, there's some tips and tricks that you can sneak into your existing process, perhaps, and still get a lot of benefit. So moving on to slide number 6, historically, I'm just finishing up writing a book on the history of agile development methods and SDLCs, but historically, large complex systems were built using something called iterative incremental development. So these are not just software, and I'm not going to stick with the software model. These include some very complex hardware components and things like that as well. Going back to the Mercury space program, the space shuttle program, which was a bit later into the 70s, the Polaris submarine and missile launch control system, the X-15 rocket plane that today still holds height and speed records for a plane. All of these kinds of projects were built using iterative incremental development methods because they were extremely complex, and in some cases, like the X-15, they weren't even sure if or how the things would work yet. They had to do a lot of experimentation and trial and error to figure out how to get things working properly. Iterative incremental development says we're going to start with the core of a solution, and then over time we're going to slowly add components onto it and build it out more richly. But at the same time, there's going to be we're going to have a view of what the end goal looks like and constantly get feedback from experiments and trials and proofs of concept to see if we're going in the right direction or not. And if we aren't, we can certainly change course very quickly and be very adaptive to the change on the project. A lot of major companies saw their methodologies as top secret competitive advantages. IBM had a methodology called Clean Room. TRW, another major defense contractor, had another proprietary methodology that they swore employees to complete secrecy over. In fact, only certain employees were allowed a complete understanding of the methodology. Other people were only shown little pieces of it so that nobody would understand the whole big picture and leak it out. So that was the environment up until about 1970. In 1970, there was a big wave of demand for people learning computer programming and systems development, et cetera. And colleges and universities wanted a new way of a public domain methodology for teaching structured software development for large projects. Up to then, any training that was done was for mostly smaller projects, data entry and analysis and reporting type applications. Now they were getting into very large-scale systems that people were starting to work on, and applications were getting more complex, and they wanted a structured way of teaching software development. A university professor named Royce created a paper that he presented in 1970 at a conference, and in that paper, you can still download it online, it's available, it's quite funny to read, he presented five different models. The very first of which, and the simplest of which, we now call the waterfall method. And in that, he also presented four other models of increasing complexity and feedback, with the last one looking very much like agile or iterative incremental development methods. But when he presented the paper, he said a couple comments. One of them was that this is how I'm going to teach. He was a university professor as well as a researcher for a defense contractor. He said, this is how I'm going to teach software development in my classes. I'm going to do it when he's presenting the waterfall method, he says it's a very structured way. I'm going to present requirements. We're going to work on it. We'll have a group assignment at the end. That's our sign-off, is the group assignment. Then we're going to do design for a term. And, at the end of the term, there's going to be an exam. And then we're going to do development for a term, and it'll be a group project that gets handed in, et cetera. So it was very much a sequential, stage-gated process, because that's how it was easy to teach software development. In his oral remarks, and in fact some of this still survives in the paper, he said, don't do this in the real world. It doesn't work. He said, this is really just a way of teaching software development. He said, in the real world, on a complex project, you're going to want to cycle through this waterfall at least a couple times. On bigger projects, maybe several times, as you get feedback and do proofs of concept and determine how it's working out. And in his comments, he said, in fact, in the real world, no significant project has ever succeeded using this waterfall method. It doesn't work for complex deals. So, people forget some of those comments, though. What ended up happening was the universities and colleges started churning out armies of programmers who all they knew was this one methodology called the waterfall method. Well, in the mid-70s and 80s, other methodologies started being introduced into the public domain to correct the error of having people only know the waterfall method and run out into the workforce and try and use it. So iterative enhancement came out in 75 with Richard Turner and Vic Vasili. In 1988, Barry Bain came out with the famous spiral development model, which still exists today as the core of the rational unified process, which is heavily based on spiral. It wasn't until the late 80s and early 90s where some of the agile experiments started bearing fruit, and you see some of the early agile methodologies like crystal methods, lean development, DSDM, and Scrum, et cetera, starting to emerge. Eventually, they got called agile in 2001, but before that, these methods were just seen as other ways of reacting to high-change projects. Moving on to slide number 7, I'm going to show you the difference between some of these different models. So So the waterfall thing had three groups of functionality, group A, group B, and group C. These are different sets of features in a new product or service that we're developing. Well, in a waterfall, you know, typical waterfall mode, we would do design of the solution in month one, we would build it in month two, and we would test it in month three. And at the end of month three, that's really the first time that the end users get a real view of what it is that we've built. And as I said at the beginning, some people are going to come back in a high change environment and say, oh, that reminds me, or oops, something's changed since you started, or the way you did it won't work here, or you know, maybe that's what I said but not what I meant. And they're going to generate change. So now you've got to go back and fix your design, redo some development, redo a whole bunch of testing, and your project is automatically late and over budget. So high change and waterfall do not go well together. If you have one of these high change projects, look at one of the other alternatives. The first is iterative development. Iterative is very much like waterfall in that we need to understand all the requirements up front. We do a design up front. We do our development, and then eventually we do our testing, and the solution still isn't ready until the end. Nothing works and is ready for acceptance testing until the very end, at the end of the 3 months. However, what we do is up front, we do a mock-up. It's not just design documents. We actually do functional prototypes. We do prototypes and mock-ups of A, B, and C. Maybe nothing works yet, but we've got all the user interfaces designed. At the end of the 1st month, we show it to the stakeholders and say, is this what you meant? Is this what you want? Did I understand you correctly? And hopefully they'll say, yeah, great, continue on. Or they might say, no, you misunderstood something. And if you misunderstood something, there's still lots of time left on the project to fix it without necessarily making the project go late and over budget. And if there's rework required, there's only a month worth of rework, not 3 months worth of rework. So it certainly helps the project adapt to, you know, changes and errors much more quickly. It also gives the user another opportunity to insert new requirements. They could say, oh, that reminds me. And now it's not that you're finding out at the end of the project. You're finding out early in the project. There's still chances to incorporate these changes during the course of the project without necessarily making the project late. We now, at the 2nd month, incorporate the changes in the feedback. We further enhance the solution by adding some of the features, kind of sort of work, maybe not everything. It's not fully tested yet, it's not fully functional yet, but maybe some of it is working enough that we can show more of how the solution is evolving and get some more feedback. We incorporate that feedback, and at the end of month three, now everything's complete and tested and working. Doesn't complete the project any faster, based on the original plan, but dramatically reduces the risk of building the wrong thing. And it gives the customer more control over the project, the business, and it gives them a greater sense of satisfaction that their real business needs are being met, not the needs that they thought they might have at the beginning of the project. So those people that don't understand what they want, they'll see it. This is the kind of methodology that works really well with them because you're giving them a chance to change their minds and provide feedback and redefine things as they go along. The next model is called incremental. Now, iterative and incremental are not interchangeable terms. A lot of people misuse them. Iterative is the concept of having a whole solution view, and that a solution slowly emerges and matures over time with lots of feedback, you know, and we do it in these cycles called iterations. Incremental is a little bit different. Incremental says we gather all the requirements up front. We prioritize the requirements. Now, the key word for incremental is prioritize. Iterative is based on feedback. Incremental is based on prioritization. We prioritize our requirements. So, for fun, let's just say A is our must-haves, B is our should-haves, and C is our nice-to-haves. If we prioritize at that, so high, medium, and low, in the 1st month, we will do design, develop, and test our must-have requirements. So at the end of month one, the must-haves are done, working, done. Now, we hand those off into some demo environment or something. We show it to the end users, give them so they can see that we're making progress, and there may be an opportunity for them to start using that in some limited fashion. Maybe they need all the requirements to put it into a production environment and get full use out of it, but maybe after the 1st month, they can get some business value from maybe showing a new product at a trade show and launching it and capturing some early market share or some early sales, beating the competitors to the punch. Maybe they can implement a partial solution for a new service before the service, all the aspects of it are fully built. Maybe they can start it and start capturing some customer mind share, some feedback from the marketplace. There may be some value. Maybe they're just going to start training support staff or call center people or something on what the new solution looks like before the less important features are complete. The idea is that after month one, your must-have stuff is all there. Now, month two, we're going to take our should-haves, and we're going to design, develop, test, and release those. Now, it doesn't necessarily have to go to production, but the business might decide to do that. The idea is that it's complete. Everything's working. It's all been fixed. There's no defects left. It's all been cleaned up. So that at any given time, at the end of any given cycle, the solution is potentially deployable should the business desire to go through the process of doing so. Now, the interesting thing is that month two isn't just B. We're building B on top of what already existed, which was A. So in month one, we've built A. In month two, we now have A plus B. And when we do month C, we get A plus B plus C. This gives us an interesting benefit. Not only could we potentially deploy a solution earlier, we could potentially end the project earlier, because maybe after A plus B, we've got our must-haves and our should-haves. We don't really need the nice-to-haves. There's not enough business value. And maybe as the business moves through the project, they quickly, as time evolves, understand the solution better and what they've asked for, and they may realize that, no, you're right, there isn't a business case to deploy that stuff. We can end the project and cut out month three altogether, saving time and saving money. There's one last benefit to incremental, and that's dramatically improved quality. If you think about it, in a waterfall project, we test at the end, only at the end. And in a three-month project, in reality, we're probably only going to have a couple weeks of testing at the end. And the project might even start late. They won't let us move the end date, and those couple weeks might get cut down to even a week. But even say we had 2 weeks, during the first week of the project, we're testing some things, we're fixing some defects, and we get to the second week of the project. Now we start testing some other areas, perhaps for the first time. If we find a high-severity defect that affects our design, when there's only a couple days left on the project, there's no time to go back and fix the design and redo development and redo a bunch of testing. The project will be late, or you're going to release something with known defects in it. Well, with incremental, that risk of that happening is dramatically reduced, because our most important features, the ones that have to work, are the ones that we build and test first. If there's any defects left over in A at the end of the first month, we still have all of the next month to fix those, as well as any new defects from the second group of features that we've added onto it. The idea being that our most critical features, feature set A, has been tested in month one. When we add B to A in month two, we don't just test B, we retest A as well to make sure adding B didn't break anything that was already there in A. So A gets tested in month one, gets retested in month two, and gets retested again in month three. So our most critical features have been tested the most number of times. We have a dramatically improved amount of quality using incremental approaches over iterative or waterfall. Agile methods combine the best of both of these. We're both iterative and incremental. We get a holistic view of the solution. We mock it up. We get feedback. We prioritize our requirements very, very narrowly into very granular elements, and then we build those elements in granular, in small iterations, small cycles. Get lots of feedback and lots of testing and retesting as we go, so the solution is potentially deployable at the end of any given cycle. So that's the difference between waterfall, agile, iterative, and incremental. Moving on to slide 8, these projects are quite different. Agile focuses on delivering value by constantly reprioritizing at the beginning of every iteration and incorporating the feedback and the changing needs of the business. We're always focusing on maximizing the amount of value we can deliver at any point in time. Waterfall is more what they call deterministic or plan-based. The concept of waterfall is we have to build the perfect plan, and then every moment on the project after that is spent trying to adhere to the plan. You know, you hear people say plan the work, then work the plan. That's a waterfall-based mentality or a deterministic mentality. The focus is completely on this plan, this ideal plan. All the metrics that we create, like percent complete, are based on that original plan. The earned value is based on comparison to our original plan, our original baseline. You know, our metrics such as variance from plan, cost variance, schedule variance are all based on the perfect plan. But as I said, in these high change projects, you can't build sometimes any plan, never mind a perfect plan. So we need to look at other approaches, and typically these empirical or observation-based models that focus on delivering business value, like Agile, are more appropriate. Speaking of which, on slide 9, the difference between empirical and deterministic. Deterministic says we can have this defined plan. Well, if you look at that graphic, deterministic or defined methodologies can be very, very successful on any kind of project. However, when the complexity of the project goes up, the probability of success for waterfall-type models rapidly drops. In fact, the diagram looks like a waterfall. And the reason is because it becomes harder and harder to build a perfect plan when the complexity starts to increase. Empirical can also make you successful on all kinds of projects, like methods like Agile. The difference is, as the complexity goes up, it delays the drop in success. In other words, when the project complexity increases, it allows a larger margin of success before the projects just get too complex for any method to be very successful. So, you know, empirical methods are really made for these high change projects. Moving on to slide 10, here, if you're looking at high change projects, Agile gives you the best overall approach. Iterative or incremental are reasonable alternatives, and waterfall is the least desirable method for high change scenarios. The difference between iterative and incremental on these is that iterative focuses more on meeting changing requirements than incremental, whereas incremental focuses more on the speed of delivering business value, the measure of efficiency. So depending on whether you're worried about speed or you're worried about meeting changing requirements, you would choose between iterative or incremental as a reasonable alternative to Agile. So in 2001, a bunch of people got together who were proponents of various Agile methods, and they weren't called Agile at the time, but they got together at a ski resort called Snowbird in Utah for the purpose of sharing ideas about how do we join forces to market our ideas to the business world to make sure that we get better buy-in and we're not fighting the same battles over and over. And at that event, they produced something called the Agile Manifesto. Slide 12 shows you what the Agile Manifesto says, and it basically stresses four philosophical points. And if you understand these, I think you'll understand the Agile methods as a whole. The first one is that it's important that we use, you know, standard tools and have good tools and you know, use the right processes in our projects. What's more important, or what contributes more to the success of the project, is having the right people and making sure they're communicating well together. You know, if you think about it, it's the old saying, a good carpenter with bad tools, still produces good work. A bad carpenter with expensive tools produces bad work. So the differentiator isn't the carpenter, or isn't the tools, it's having the right person, the right carpenter. So here it's the same thing. If we have the right, we still need methods and tools in our project. And I'm not saying we don't need them, that's a big misunderstanding. We need the right processes and controls and the right tools, but the focus shouldn't be on the method, it should be more on the people and making sure they're working well together. Also, if we're looking at a software development project, the point of the project is to create software, not documentation. This is another misunderstanding. Agile doesn't mean don't document. It means don't spend so much time documenting that you never get around to creating deliverables. Really think through which documents are absolutely necessary, and you know, always keep the eye on the real measure of true performance is completed working stuff, is deliverables that the business really cares about. Now, sometimes they care about documentation, and that's fine. But if the project is not about creating documentation, it's about creating something else, really focus on what the business cares about. Yes, you need to create documentation along the way, But as some programmers I met with recently said, today they spend more time writing documents than they do writing software. They said they shouldn't be called programmers, but rather technical writers. We don't want that scenario. The last two are largely related. They're about how we work with the stakeholders. Instead of arguing over the contract, collaborate with the stakeholders to figure out how you can incorporate those changes and still into the project and still keep the project moving forward. They can't control change. Change happens outside in the world. These are high change projects, so expect a lot of change. Don't try and argue over them constantly with a confrontational attitude. You know, you need to work with them to figure out how you can best incorporate these changes to help them be successful in their business. And lastly, don't try and stick to that original plan. The plan is a fiction. It's your best guess at what might happen. As the real project starts to unfold, respond to the change, figure out how to incorporate the changes into your plans rather than trying to force the project to artificially stick to a plan. Now, I'm not saying we don't plan. We do. But the importance is really being responsive to those changes and the stakeholders' changing needs rather than adhering artificially to the plan. If you do this, you're going to improve visibility into the project by having them constantly looking at the end of every iteration or every cycle, your work in progress and giving you feedback. They're going to be more happy with the results because they feel more involved and you're more responsive to their changes by delivering, by using the incremental aspects of Agile. You're being able to deliver possibly sooner by ending the project a bit earlier and not working on those nice-to-haves that they don't really need, and delivering their value much faster. And overall, this is all meant to reduce risk. Agile is all about reducing risk on high-change projects. The risk of building the wrong thing, the risk of delivering the project late, the risk of poor quality, all of these are dramatically reduced in Agile. So, moving on to slide 15, I'm going to talk briefly about Scrum. Scrum is the most common Agile project management method. It is probably in 90-plus percent of all Agile projects or companies that say they're doing Agile using some variant of Scrum. Scrum focuses on two things: empower the team to make the decisions that they need to optimize their project, and the second one is use this concept of iterative incremental development. Moving on to slide 16, this diagram kind of summarizes Scrum quite nicely. We start with a prioritized list of features. Remember, prioritization comes from the incremental aspect, and that's really important. We prioritize a set of features. We go into a planning session with the client. In that planning session, among other things, we group the features in order of priority, in order of we look at things like dependencies, et cetera, but we figure out how many of those features we can do in any given iteration or any given cycle, and we carve up the list. So in this case, we said we can do features 1, 3, and 7 in one iteration, features 2, 4, and 5 in the next iteration, and feature 6 is left over, and we're just going to put it back into the bucket of stuff that we haven't built yet. We call that the backlog. So we go now and execute that first iteration's worth of stuff, the features 1, 3, and 7. In Scrum, we call that iteration a sprint, but it's the same thing. It's an iteration. We go and do the iteration's worth of work, design, develop, test, and when we get ready at the end of the iteration, we do a demonstration with the client. We demo our work in progress and capture feedback. And that feedback could be new features, defects they might have found during the demo. It could be misunderstandings of requirements. Any of those items goes into the backlog, which is the stuff that we haven't done yet. And before we start the second iteration, this is very important, we replan. So even though we said 2, 4, and 5 were the next most important features that we were going to work on the next iteration, maybe business scenario has changed. Maybe a new feature is now more important than feature 4, and a new requirement has come in. Or maybe feature 6 wasn't important, but now it's really important, and we're going to do that instead of feature 5. So we go into this replanning activity, and this is where what allows us to be very responsive to changing customer needs. So we replan, we readjust this list, we go back, we do the second iteration or the second sprint, we design, develop, test, and we do the demo again, and we keep cycling through this process over and over until we're out of time, we're out of money, or there's nothing left in the backlog, or the client says, that's good enough. I don't need what's left in the backlog. It's not worth me spending extra money. A really important set of management controls exists for Scrum, and I show that on slide 17. One of them is a daily team meeting where we can look for issues and foster collaboration and knowledge sharing amongst the team. Really important is this daily meeting is it gives us instant visibility into issues. We don't wait for a weekly status report to find out there's a problem. I'll know within 24 hours. There's really only two things I ask of my team. One is to give me is to attend this daily meeting, and it's very short. We keep them to about 15 minutes in length. We just ask a couple questions and let the team get back to their work. And the second thing that they have to do is update their estimates to complete. We have a work breakdown structure for the current iterations worth of work, and each task has an estimate next to it, and we track their estimates to complete. We tally the total estimate to complete, and we plot it on a graph as a trend line. At the beginning of an iteration, you know, it's 100% left to do, like nothing's been done yet. So in this case, the example I show you, there was 1,100 hours at the beginning of the iteration. As we go through, the estimate to complete drops because we're making progress, we're doing some work. But every once in a while, it might jump up or it might be flat for a few days. These are points of management interest. As soon as I see that, I know there's something I need to go find out. If it jumps up, it usually means they've discovered additional work or they discovered something's harder than they thought. If it's flat for a bit, it might be vacation, illness, you know, somebody pulled the fire alarm and everybody was gone. Or it could be they're being blocked by another team not giving a dependency or a deliverable to them. It's certainly something for me to investigate as a manager to find out what's going on. But at any given point in time, if I plot the trend line of the graph forward, I forecast it forward towards the x-axis, I can see what date this iteration is likely to complete on. In this case, I had a one-month iteration, and I could see that the project generally was moving along quite well and at very high odds of completing on time. But there were a couple times where the trend of that line was going in the wrong direction, and I took management action to make sure that it got back on track. Those are called burndown charts, and they're very important in Scrum. So, you know, Scrum also works very well on troubled projects, if you have any, because, you know, usually you have very senior management involved on a troubled project, and they're going to be very focused on allowing you to break the rules to get things back on track, and you can try different innovative things like Scrum. They make decisions instantly. They like the visibility of progress by looking at these burndown charts. They also want to participate in these daily team meetings to make sure that any issues that are raised can be escalated and dealt with instantly. So it's very helpful on those types of projects. Extreme programming is a little bit different. Remember I said extreme programming was part of that Chrysler compensation system. Well, on slide 21, we see the 12 key practices of extreme programming, and they sound very similar to Scrum. You know, we have the whole team working holistically together in planning and delivery. We keep everything in small releases or small iterations to make it easy to incorporate feedback on these high change projects. We continuously integrate, which means we put all of our deliverables into a demo environment together to make sure that everything's working together. You need standards to make sure this works and some kind of upfront design to make sure that, or a metaphor as they call it in extreme programming, to make sure that everyone's moving in the right direction. We keep our design simple. We every once in a while there will be some rework. There's going to be a little bit of what they call refactoring as new requirements come about that may change some of the work that you've done. But by following these practices, you can keep the project under control. Feature-driven development is the one that came about from that Singapore project, that commercial leasing application. And on slide 24, I give you a view of feature-driven development. And look at the steps. Develop an overall model, so that's some upfront design. Out of that comes the features list. That's that initial list or that backlog. You plan by feature. That's where we do our planning and break the project into a number of iterations or a number of cycles. Based on priority, and then we go through an iterative process where we design by feature and build by feature. We do our detailed design, our detailed build, go back, detailed design, detailed build, go back, and we cycle through that until we're done. Very similar, it's just a different view, but very similar to what we described for Scrum. So what are some of these techniques you can use today? Well, one of them is you can start using iterative and incremental development. In other words, break your project down into cycles and deliver your working stuff in little bits and pieces that build on each other to your end stakeholders. Now, some of you are going to say, oh, but I'm a waterfall shop. Our standard methodology is waterfall. And I'll say, great. What you have now is not a project, it's a program. The program is broken into a whole bunch of little projects. Maybe each one's 1 month long now. And you've got a bunch of one-month waterfalls, end on end. Each one is really a one-month iteration. You're really doing iterative incremental development. But to the process police in your organization, it's a bunch of one-month projects, end on end, that are following your standard practices and tools. You're not fully agile, but just by breaking your project down into a bunch of one-month waterfalls, end on end, you're getting probably, you know, maybe 70% of the value of agile, you know, and dramatically improving the trust you have between your stakeholders and the delivery team by making smaller commitments that you can meet, by being more responsive to their changes, by allowing them to change their minds about what they might need throughout the process. You're being your team morale will go higher because they're not getting stuck in a design phase, but they're actually making progress and producing stuff. Certainly, one-month iterations, you know, work for many people. They might be too long for you. You might need feedback on a more frequent cycle. You might be able to go down to 3 weeks or 2 weeks. Some people even do 1 week or even 1 day cycles, but that requires extreme discipline, very skilled senior people, and a lot of automated tools to help you with your project work. So I don't recommend you start with short iteration lengths. Keep them at 3 or 4 weeks when you're getting started. But you can certainly do it in a waterfall environment and get some of the benefit of agile without actually being quote-unquote agile. Another one is use agile requirements gathering and documentation techniques. You know, make sure you understand the business case when you're gathering requirements to make sure you prioritize them appropriately. If these are high-change projects, don't spend a lot of time doing detailed requirements analysis on items that are further down the list in order of priority or further out on the project schedule because they're probably going to change before you get there. When you gather requirements, consider who the stakeholders are and how likely it is that they're going to change their mind about what they want, look at the technical environment that could generate change on the project or any other areas that could affect a particular requirement. Requirements at high risk of change should certainly only be planned at a high level until you get closer to the day you're about to do some work on that requirement. You know, it needs to be only high level so that the team knows enough detail that they can, you know, design the overall solution and not get into a lot of trouble. But there's no point in doing detailed requirements analysis really early in the project in a high change project for things that are much further out. They're going to change before you get there. You may never even build them. It may go away before you get there. So we don't want to waste effort. PMI calls this rolling wave planning. It works. You do high level for the whole project, and then you do detailed only one iteration at a time just before the start of the iteration. That works really well. Documentation is similar. You know, you try to keep document things that aren't likely to change. Otherwise, if you document too early, you're going and procrastinate on your documentation as well if you can, because if you document too early, now you got to keep maintaining and updating these documents throughout the life of the project, and that's a lot of rework and can consume a lot of resources. The third technique that I suggest you try is something called test-driven development, and what this means is when you gather new requirements, also, while you're gathering the requirements, ask for the acceptance criteria at that time. By understanding the acceptance criteria right up front, or in other words, how will the customer know that you've met this requirement? What is their test to make sure that that requirement has been satisfied? If you gather that up front, really they're giving you their acceptance test cases, but they're not thinking that way yet. You ask them about, you know, their acceptance criteria. If you gather that up front and give that to the solution designers and the solution builders, and in software world, it's the programmer. You know, they're going to use that as design input and design the solution only good enough to pass those test cases so that you don't get, you know, over-designed solutions. That's going to make your project a little bit more efficient. And, in fact, if the development team of the service or the solution are using the same acceptance criteria that the business is going to use to accept the solution at the end, the development team can use those as their own internal test criteria to make sure that the solution already passes all those acceptance test criteria before they turn the solution over to the business for final acceptance. If they've already used the same test cases and it's already passed in the development environment, when they turn it over to the business for final acceptance, it should slide right through. There should be no surprises. And that's going to dramatically improve the trust and the relationship with the business and should save time and money overall on the project as well. So I've tried to adhere as much as I can to our original schedule. It's now 10 o'clock. We're at the top of the hour. I'm going to open up the lines for questions. Henry, if you could. But in the meantime, my contact information is on slide 29, kevin@agilepm.com. If we don't get a chance to answer your questions on this call, or if you think of a question later, or perhaps you're too shy to ask it in front of the group, you can always email it to me, and I will get back to you. If you don't mind, I share some of the questions and answers on the Agile PM newsletter, and if you're interested in signing up for that free newsletter, it's at agilepm.com as well. Henry, go ahead.
Yeah, Kevin, thank you very much. Very informative. I think that might be a good idea for you also. Kevin, is it agilepm.com is the website that you'd prefer people to contact you through if they didn't catch your email address?
Yeah, that's fine. Kevin@agilepm.com is fine.
Okay, and your website is preferred website is agilepm.com?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and I did, while we were talking, I actually did go and call the conference call customer service line to see if they could look into the call quality. It seemed to improve there for a while, so we'll be working on that with the provider. And at this time, if anybody has any questions, because I've muted the lines, you'll need to push star 6 to unmute your line. And, you know, we'd like to hear some questions from the audience out there, if we could. All right, well, I'll tell you what, I'll try to break the ice a little bit, as it were. Kevin, could you do us a favor? Could you go back over the differences between having an iterative approach and the, now I'm forgetting what the other term is, but the iterative approach and the one that we usually get it confused with.
Iterative and incremental.
Right. Incremental, thank you very much.
Yeah.
This was the
difference is iterative focuses on gathering feedback. So you would use an iterative approach when you desperately need feedback to make sure you're building the right thing. So if the requirements are fuzzy or you have stakeholders who are very hesitant or not sure what they want, then iterative is very important because it means we gather an initial set of requirements. They might be fuzzy. We might not be fully understanding them, but we can go and design, maybe do a mock-up. If you're designing software, a good example would be we'd create all the we'd mock up all the screens, create the user interfaces, and then we'd come back and show them to the stakeholders and say, is this what you guys meant? Is this what you want? Will this satisfy your needs? And you're going to get feedback from people saying things like, well, you're close. We don't have that information at that step in the process. That'll have to appear on another screen. Or, the fields that you laid out are good, but you missed a couple. Or, you're going to get some feedback about what's going to make it work better in their environment or better meet their business needs. You capture that feedback. You go away. You update the solution to include those changes. You also work on it some more in the background, and now maybe some of the stuff is working. So you come back and you show it to them again. And Matt, now, the user interface shows the changes they request, but maybe some of the buttons actually do something when you click them. You can submit a transaction and get a response, or you can look up a list of customers, or you can do whatever. Some of these things actually are actually functional now, perhaps. You get some more feedback from them. And you go back and you make more changes and enhance the solution further, and you come back again and get more feedback. The system really isn't ready for delivery still until the end. It's still like waterfall in that, you're doing your design and your development, but it's really not tested and completely ready until the very end of the project still. But you're getting lots of feedback. You're constantly going back saying, is this what you want? Is this what you want? Is this what you want? Kind of like a very insecure grade 3 student going back and forth to his teacher. The value in that is making sure that they feel involved and they can redirect the project if it gets off course very quickly. There is a management overhead with that, and you got to keep scheduling those demonstrations to the customer to get those the feedback. And if you don't have access to a customer, that method isn't going to work.
That actually runs into another question I'm going to ask, but I'll let you describe incremental. But I wanted to ask you too: are there places that you've seen where, you know, these agile approaches don't work? But why don't you go into the incremental first, and then you can answer that question.
Certainly, incremental is the and incremental is focused not so much on feedback. We're assuming that we can work with the client once up front, gather their list of requirements, prioritize them, which is the key word for incremental, is the prioritization. And that's basically go away, and we don't really have a lot of interaction with the client from that point forward, but we deliver in chunks. So we'll go away and complete some of the work, the highest priority elements of the work, and turn it over potentially to the clients. It's ready for them. We put it in a demo environment, or we turn it over to them and say, here you go, here's the first bit. Now they make a business decision. Do we want to do anything with this, or is it not, have we not reached critical mass yet? And they may say, you know what, no. Usually it takes several iterations to get enough stuff added to the growing solution to make it worthwhile for them to do acceptance testing or put it in a demo environment or show it to stakeholders or whatever. But you still give them the option, right? And we're delivering it in a series of chunks, each one building on the previous work. It's kind of like Lego. You know, you start with the core and you start bolting on new pieces and snapping them on, and the creation gets bigger and bigger over time. That's the concept of incremental. Agile, as I said, is a bit of both. You're getting lots of feedback, but you're getting feedback on stuff that's done, stuff that works, rather than mock-ups and designs and work in progress like you would with iterative. Now, where would you not use Agile? Any methodology can be used on any project, but as I showed you, some of them have sweet spots. Agile is not the right answer to every problem, and I think most organizations should have at least a couple methodologies to deal with different projects of a different nature. If your requirements are very, very stable, you're not going to have a lot of change. Say, for example, you're doing a software project to rewrite an existing mainframe application, from COBOL, and you're going to redo it in Java for, you know, a web-based solution or something like that. So you're basically porting the solution from one technology to another. Then Agile may not be your best approach because you don't need a lot of feedback. The requirements are exactly the same as what the legacy system is. It's not going to change. It's just do the exact same thing on a new technology. Then maybe Agile isn't the right approach, but you might want to go with incremental for the testing benefits, the constant retesting to make sure your high severity defects are all flushed out early. Agile works best, as I said, in these highly complex environments. However, because you haven't done all the thinking through of the solution, the detailed design up front of the whole solution, it's possible you might miss something. So if your solution is life or mission critical, like if you're designing software to calculate radiation dosages, in a hospital environment, in a chemotherapy unit or a radiation therapy unit, or if you're doing software for nuclear reactor control, I wouldn't want to use Agile for fear that we would miss something because we haven't done all the upfront thinking it through and all the design reviews. You can use Agile in those environments, but there's a risk. And you might want to do more of a waterfall detailed design phase up front, and once you've got all the sign-offs and all the reviews and everybody's thinking it through, maybe you could use Agile or incremental to build it, but you certainly don't want to use Agile for that upfront work, or you're going to get into some trouble possibly.
Okay. That's helpful to know.
And as I said before, Agile incurs a bit of a different cost curve. You're going back and forth to the client constantly saying, is this what you want? Is this what you want? Look how we've done. That incurs a lot of extra cost for those interactions with the client, a lot of extra meetings. You're going to use more project manager time in an Agile project than you will in a waterfall project. You're going to use more architecture time solution design time, but you're going to save overall because you're catching defects far earlier when it's easier and cheaper to fix them with less rework and less impact on the project. So costs overall are probably about the same. However, you're going to incur a different mix of resources on an Agile project.
Interesting. Good thoughts there. That's some good learning right there in just the last couple of minutes. Appreciate that.
Yep.
Anybody have any questions? You'll need to push *6 to unmute your phone if you have a question.
Hey, this is Rich Crow. I just want to say it was a great presentation. In my fairly new employment over the last few months as a role of client relationship manager, I can use some of these concepts with some of the projects they bring to me where they don't know how to interact with technology. But this has been really, really be good for me. You know, some of these concepts I can focus on, you know, some of them and then mix some of them up depending on what the requirements are.
Excellent. I'm glad you got some value out of it. And congratulations on the new job.
Thanks. Thank you.
Did you have a question?
No. But just basically where I'm going to use it. I'm not a full-time project manager, but I interact with between lines of businesses and our technology group. And this these types of concepts will definitely come in handy. Breaking things down.
Yeah, it's very important even just to how to structure the work and to figure out what benefits there are for the business. One of the books. There's a book I talked about. It's on the cover page for this slide deck, and I think it's the third one on the last page there. It's called Managing Agile Projects. This book has a whole – it's written for managers. It's written for business, right, not technology people, unlike most Agile books. And the first whole section of the book is really about what's in it for the business. How do you sell it to business? What are the benefits and risks of Agile? And then there's the second section is on how it's different from traditional projects. The third section is a bunch of Agile techniques that you can sneak into your existing processes without adopting a whole new methodology. And the last one is really about how to sneak it into your organization without getting caught. It's all about Agile deployment and adoption and how to, how to get the business to buy in. That might be of interest to you. Now, I don't make a dime off this book. All the author royalties go to charity, the International Red Cross Disaster Relief Fund. I was the editor of the book, wrote some of the chapters, and a lot of the Agile gurus who invented these methodologies contributed chapters to the book. So there's a lot of really good stuff in there, and it's one of the few books aimed at PMs and business managers rather than techies. So there might be some interest in there for you.
Good, and that was the third one, Managing Agile Projects?
Yeah, there's two books by that title. Make sure you get the one with the juggler guy on the cover.
with the juggling guy. Okay. Okay, very good. Thanks.
Good, thank you.
Any other questions? Remember, you'll need to push *6. Okay, I guess not. So, Kevin, I just want to end by saying thank you very much for donating your time to the profession. Really appreciate you coming on the call. PMLessonsLearned.com is a group of project managers helping project managers to make a difference. And we really don't have any, funds for our group. We don't really work that way. We try to extend everything we do. It's all extended on a free basis, and, it's just people donating their time. Somebody asked me recently about the group and how we work. And one of the things I pointed out to them is we're also made up of a bunch of project managers that really care about learning how to do their jobs better, because where a lot of other groups are established or organizations are established where they give PDUs, we are not a registered education provider at this time anyway. We don't have any real plans to do that. So we don't offer PDUs. I guess you probably could claim something as self-study perhaps, but
actually this presentation, Henry, people can claim one PDU under Category 4 other providers.
Oh, really? That's interesting to know. Who would they put as
because
the provider?
Because they gave their name to you up front, and you recorded those names. You can verify their attendance. And if they did not give the name, they would claim it under Category 2, self-directed learning.
I wasn't familiar with that. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate that as well, because we've had a lot of people asking about that. So the other thing that I wanted to mention, too, is earlier I think I gave the wrong email address. If you're interested in the PMT study group, those of you listening into the call, the real address would be pmpstudy@pmlessonslearned.com. I think I gave the wrong email address for that. So if you're interested in that group, pmpstudy@pmlessonslearned.com. And one other thing that I wanted to mention, and we're looking for a volunteer to help us with this, but right now, if you would give us some feedback on our speaker, whether you're listening to this via the podcast or whether you're listening to this live, we would appreciate you going to our webpage and using the contact us link to give us some feedback on the speaker, because as I said, we don't have any funds to pay our speakers, so we like to at least give them feedback on their presentation. And if you could give some concise information about why you like the presentation or what you learned from it or how you can apply it, or if you have any questions or whatever, we like to try to get feedback to the speakers, because they're doing this on a fee gratis basis. You know, they're not getting paid for this, so we try to give them feedback if possible. And I've had a lot of speakers asking me lately, did you get any feedback on the call? And we're trying to establish a feedback program. And if anybody's interested in volunteering for that, putting together some surveys and using maybe some free services to do that, I know there's some out there, we would really appreciate it if a volunteer would step forward to help with that. But in the meantime, if you would just send to the contact us link on our homepage and give us some feedback about Kevin Iguano and his presentation this evening, or any of our other speakers, we'd really appreciate being able to pass that back to them. So thank you very much, everyone, for tuning in, and thank you, Kevin, for your time that you've provided to us to present. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, everyone.
And for everybody on the call, if you want to stick on and discuss some other PM-related topics, as usual, we'll be staying on the call for a little bit for some discussion. And I want to just thank everybody for joining us. And as I usually say when I sign off, God bless you all and keep on learning.
This has been a PM Lessons Learned podcast. Project Managers, helping project managers by sharing lessons learned. Come join our group. Visit our website at pmlessonslearned.com. Till next time, keep on learning.